got to ask.
Come to Los Angeles. The sun shines bright, the beaches are wide and inviting, and the orange grove stretches far as the eye can see. There are jobs aplenty, and land is cheap. Every working man can have his own house, and inside every house, a happy all-American family. You can have all this, and who knows? You could even be discovered, become a movie star, or at least see one. Life is good in Los Angeles. It's paradise on earth. That's what they tell you anyway.
And now,
a worried man with a worried mind. No one in front of me and nothing behind. There's a woman on my lap and she's drinking champagne. Got white skin, got assassin's eyes. I'm looking up into the sapphire tinted skies. I'm wild dressed, waiting on the last train. Standing on the gallows with my head in the news. Any minute now I'm expecting all hell. People are crazy and talks are strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed.
Your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness. Celebrity deaths.
Dean Haglund, when we recorded just a few days ago and decided that we needed to record early this week because of both of our performance and travel schedules, I had a little bit of a fear that, well, are we really in just a few days going to have enough to fill a show, especially in the wake of what was an epic installment of Chilpack Hollywood.
Epic!
Mm-hmm. And then, boy, just one thing after another started happening in the world, and I realized maybe we've waited too long to do a new show. But one of the things was the death of Curtis Hanson.
Yes.
Filmmaker.
Director.
71 years of age. Only 71. I mean, we do live at a time where it's only 71 years of age, right?
Not, I know, right?
Not just because that's not old, but also because many people are contributing so much, especially in the creative arts, into their 70s and 80s and even their 90s. He retired in 2012 after co-directing a documentary called Chasing Mavericks about surfing with Michael Apted, the great filmmaker behind the 7-Up series. He retired after that due to frontotemporal dementia. And that is why not much had been heard recently from this supremely talented but also truly gentle man. I don't know if you ever saw him in interviews or speak about issues of film preservation or film history. The word gentleman really, you know, if you look up gentleman in a dictionary, you'll get the definition of gentleman, which is what he was.
Wow. No, I never did see it.
You avail yourself of the opportunity. I actually have him speaking about some great films on, you know, behind the scenes making of documentaries in classic editions, you know, especially of films of the 40s and 50s. He got his start, as so many filmmakers who would come of age in the 80s did, writing for Roger Corman.
Roger Corman, of course. Classic.
He produced, Roger Corman produced a Lovecraft adaptation called The Dunwich Horror, which received pretty good notices, especially for a Roger Corman film. Back in 1970, and the screenplay to that was Curtis Hanson's first script.
Well,
he wrote the terrific 1978 Canadian heist picture, The Silent Partner.
Of course. So rare, the Canadian heist movie genre.
I think that movie is overlooked. You know, we were talking last week about how sometime we'll do a show about the top 10 most overlooked science fiction films of all time. I think right. Silent Partner might be overlooked.
I think so, too.
It's so sharp and so funny and dark and disturbing, with great lead performances from Elliot Gould, who was at the tail end of his major stardom, and Christopher Plummer, who had yet to enter that second wave of major stardom for himself. Let's see. Curtis Hanson also wrote the very successful and well-received 1985 Never Cry Wolf, and continued to write so many more screenplays. He directed 15 narrative feature films, including such hits as Hand That Rocks the Cradle and The River Wild. Remember, he turned Meryl Streep into an action star.
That's right, with the whitewater rafting. Him and her and Kevin Bacon.
I always remember you being kind of impressed by that.
Yes, I was, actually. Well, because of that footage, too. Having gone whitewater rafting, can't imagine trying to film, take a camera on the boat and capture that action. But I thought that did a good job, actually.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, people always talk about the challenge of Jaws, right, on the water.
And, yeah.
How about water that's moving really, really quickly over rocks?
Yeah.
Then he emerges from those hits and directs three, I think it's safe to call them modern masterpieces, beginning with L.A. Confidential.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got into this conversation the other day. Someone said to me, can you imagine that didn't win Best Picture? And I said, of course it didn't. Titanic won. And they said, really? I said, yeah. They said Titanic was nominated for Best Picture. So it's amazing how time changes things, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
But yes, L.A. Confidential at that time was seen as the only film with a chance to upset Titanic. And now years later, people are upset that L.A. Confidential didn't win. After that, he did two films that were released in 2000, both of which are, I believe, absolute masterpieces. One is 8 Mile. And, you know, Eminem and that music, not exactly up my alley. And,
right.
And that's a great movie.
Yeah, yeah. It's Struggle of the Working Class and all that. Greedy.
And what I would have if we did a show of the 10 most overlooked movies ever in any genre, Wonder Boys, starring Michael Douglas, Robert Downey Jr., Tobey Maguire, all three of whom give among their best performances ever in this movie. It's one of the most literate films. Frances McDormand at her most charming, most beautiful. I had an acting student who told me that Frances McDormand is his favorite performer. And when I asked, what about Frances McDormand is it that we love? And he said, and I think you'll dig this, he said, because in every role she does, she brings an entire world with her.
Mm, that's so true.
Isn't that a fabulous compliment to pay an actor?
That is fantastic.
Anyway, so she's the heart of that movie. Michael Douglas is very much the soul of that movie. Like I said, so literate. Supporting performances by Rip Torn, Alan Tudyk, Richard Thomas, young, fresh, blindingly sparkling Katie Holmes before her light dimmed. Just a magnificent movie, and it could only, again, have been helmed, written and directed not only by a very wise and literate and funny man, but again, a very gentle and compassionate one. And I think that that's true. That's why 8 Mile is so good, is the person behind it brings such great compassion to it.
Absolutely. You could have gone really macho with that and made it super aggressive, but there's that underlying pathos and like you said, a gentleness to that whole movie that really counteracts the aggression of rap battles and working in a steel mill and all that sort of thing.
Our opening of this show included Danny DeVito's narration from the first scene of Los Angeles Confidential, L.A. Confidential, and then segued into Bob Dylan's Oscar-winning theme song from Wonder Boys. I wanted to mention to you, we're talking about all these overlooked films. Olav Phillips, our friend, came up with another great potential nominee for most overlooked science fiction films of all time. We certainly encourage people to send us their suggestions at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. I've enlisted Alex Lefchuk on the Midweek Drive. I'm going to reach out to Louis Savvy. So please have those suggestions come in. Most overlooked science fiction films of all time. They don't have to be great. They can even be mostly bad if you think, but come up with a case for why they're overlooked, right?
Right.
And real head scratchers. That's what we're looking for. But anyway, right now, of course, you know, like how was this overlooked? I mentioned, you know, Quintet last week, I think it was with, you know, it stars Paul Newman and is directed by Robert Altman. And it's in the 70s when both of them were world famous. How does no one know about this movie? But anyway, but today we celebrate Curtis Hanson dead at 71. And I urge everyone, if you haven't had a chance to see Wonder Boys, I can't imagine you not loving it, man, woman, or young person. And when I say young person, I don't mean aspiring filmmakers, though aspiring filmmakers might enjoy it as well.
Totally. But what was Olav Phillips? Oh, Quintet. Yeah.
But he came up with another one. But I'm not gonna give it away until we do the show because it's a terrific.
Damn you!
Terrific.
Damn you!
Well, I might to you. I might tell you about it. We should share because it's possible that one or the other of us will have seen the film. But I don't think we should give it away. Otherwise, all we're doing for that top 10 is just cutting together clips over the week of when, hey, we got another one. And don't kid yourself, I've thought of doing that before. We promised, Dean, that we would talk about the Emmys this week. They took place literally while we were recording last week.
Yes.
And have one bit of news to share with you. The numbers are in, of course, and it's the least watched Emmy Awards telecast in the history of the award show.
Even though it's the most diverse, so it's not about diversity that's keeping the folks away from watching.
No.
Everybody congratulating themselves.
Less than 10 million people, not less than 9.5 million people watched it. I mean, a really low-rated show. And personal highlight, I guess, in terms of the awards being given is Rami Malek winning for Mr. Robot. You know, look, there's other really great performances being given. But I think you might agree with me that no one is lifting the heavy water to the degree that that Rami Malek is in the first season of Mr. Robot.
So good.
It is. It's all through his point of view. It's all dependent upon him. And it's a character and a performance unlike any we've ever seen on television before.
True. And how hard is that to get these days?
Yeah. Yeah. So congratulations to him. I will say this. Jimmy Kimmel absolutely killed it as the host. It may be the best job of hosting an award show I have ever seen.
Really? Because I'm not a Kimmel fan.
I am. Well, no, I've enjoyed some of his things when he went on Jay Leno's show and ripped Leno a new one for pushing Conan O'Brien out of the show. That was unbelievable. That was a great performance. Jimmy Kimmel's tribute the night before David Letterman's retirement was fantastic. It was so personal and it was so well communicated. So there are times when Jimmy Kimmel... he's gifted. I will say that he's gifted as a host, but I'm not a fan. And there's a degree to which I think maybe his lack of range and versatility might have something to do with it. The sameness of his tone. But I will tell you that he did what he does the best I have ever seen it. And he really did what we always want from a host, and he did it better than anyone I have ever seen.
True, and I got to give him kudos for having the Matt Damon moment, where Matt Damon goes, "Oh, hey, you lost. That must be a bummer for you." Yeah. And clearly, that you know, delivered so well on Matt Damon's part, but to him and Taker, take it like a guy just for losing and make it a point of it, of how funny that is.
But the way that he would take elephants in the room and make them into jokes that might have a little bite to them. They weren't harmless jokes, but the way that everyone could laugh around them, we could get over the issue. So, for example, there's a lot of complaints about how Transparent dominates in certain categories, comedy categories, even though it's not a comedy.
Right.
And his line about how, hey, you all need to remember that Transparent was born a drama, but it identifies as a comedy.
Yeah,
and
fun line.
It was a great line, and that pretty well diffuses. It's the kind of line that diffuses controversy, right? We can have fun with it, because after all, these are just awards, man.
Right.
And
as we found out, nobody really cares.
Yeah, and you know, asking the OJ team, look, if you get Cuba Gooding, you gave a great performance. When you get up there, are you going to thank OJ Simpson?
It's true.
You know, this is what we want to know. And asking that question of him in the audience, feeling fairly certain that Cuba Gooding Jr. is not going to win, so we're not going to get to find out otherwise, is fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So, by all means, look up some highlights of some of the things that Jimmy Kimmel did. Some of the stuff was wonderfully subtle. I liked in his opening montage sequence, trying to get to the Emmys. There's a great bit with him and James Corden doing James Corden's car karaoke bit. But there's also some wonderful subtle stuff when he's left at the side of the road and you see parked in the corner of the frame one of the energy trucks from Netflix's Stranger Things.
Right.
You know, so it was verbal, but there was also visual. And so hats off to him. We rarely talk about Jimmy Kimmel.
Right.
Again, because we're not fans, but I will say I do understand why people are fans of his.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a spectacular job. And often people I really admire and really enjoy fail in that role. So it's no small thing.
It's thankless for sure.
Last week, during our Epic podcast, we discussed the Colin Kaepernick saga, protesting the treatment of people of color in the United States of America, and how that pregame national anthem-based protest has played out in terms of civic discourse.
Right.
We know that our numbers of listeners to this podcast have never been legion. However, we know they are mighty. And we know that, and if you've listened to your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, you know that we are a shadowy influence upon the cultural conversation.
Absolutely.
So,
and we don't rub ourselves. We don't pat our backs about it.
No,
we just continue on.
No, we just simply point out that no sooner do we record a show about Colin Kaepernick's protest, then, there's another unarmed African-American that gets shot and killed at the hand of police officers, this time in Tulsa, mm-hmm. Oklahoma. And all of a sudden, for a few days at least, Kaepernick's critics silenced. No word from anyone about how what Colin Kaepernick is doing is unpatriotic, it's disrespectful, it's tearing at the fabric of America. Those people, thank God, shut the hell up for a few days. Because the point is, black lives do matter. And maybe they understood that to say otherwise or to do one of those, hey, but all lives matter, would be really distasteful in the wake of yet another act of senseless brutality by police against African-Americans. Today, and again, we're recording this early. We're recording this, ladies and gentlemen, on a Thursday here in the States, a Friday there down under. And today, Time Magazine revealed that their cover for next week, the week beginning when you are hearing this podcast, Their cover for next week is Colin Kaepernick kneeling against a black background with the story entitled His Perilous Fight.
Wow. So there you go.
Yeah.
The conversation continues.
And one can only imagine why the Time magazine cover comes after a podcast with Hollywood in its name weighs in on this issue rather than, say, before.
Yeah.
We pave the way. We pave the way for conversation. And it's a duty and a burden and an obligation and a responsibility and an honor that we take quite seriously.
Absolutely. Now, seeing this from a distance of the future, that being tomorrow, there is some facts that I'm shocked to learn about how police are trained in the U.S., some of them having only 8 hours of sensitivity training and that sort of thing, as opposed to, say, Swedish or Norwegian police officers, which have to train for 3 years as a rookie, going through all sorts of psychological and simulations of all sorts to make sure that this kind of thing never happens.
What was the example that you gave? Swedish or what? What was the example?
Norwegian police force. Yeah. Both of them have extensive training periods to be a police officer, and you're not given a gun until you're in your first year. So it's not just arming up with all the latest in the military GAC that has been sold off to police forces, which I'm also shocked to learn have no federal standard. Each county trains their police in their own peculiar way.
Couldn't one make a case that it's beyond police and we don't teach physical sensitivity, period? I mean, there's got to be a reason that no one goes into a massage parlor asking for an American massage.
That's true.
Right? We ask for many kinds of massages from around the world, but never an American one. And isn't that what we want from our police officers? The ability to massage a potentially tense situation.
Absolutely. How to devolve the buildup of energy.
Defuse the situation.
Absolutely. So if you have no training in diffuse it, and everybody is hyped aware, and we all live in an age of Grand Theft Auto simulation of how to deal with violence, in that you just shoot and punch your way out, there's no other way, then there's got to be something, even if it's federally mandated, in terms of how specifically law enforcement people who get armed have some psychological conditioning so that they themselves can get themselves out of a situation.
Of course, you're making it sound dangerously like you're trying to take our guns away, because if you mandate sensitivity training, then the next thing you know, we're going to have peace without honor.
There's not a direct line between those two things.
Debates in this country always follow a direct line. You've been out of America way too long.
Well,
man.
I certainly have, haven't I?
You've gone down under, but everything here goes sideways. This all comes up again from a protest over the national anthem. So if I can take what your observation, which all jokes aside is, I think really you've given this some thought. If I can take that observation and apply it back to the issue of national anthem, I've maintained, as you know, before, mostly seriously, the position that we need a different national anthem. One of the reasons, look, I would have, first of all, I would have preferred the national anthem to have been written by a songwriter and not an attorney. That would have been nice.
Well, the lyrics are by an attorney. The melody is an old beer drinking song. Like, that is historically a song you sang in the taverns, that melody, and then he just put new words on top of it. So that's the first lesson you should learn about the national anthem.
Well, I would have liked a song with lyrics by a songwriter, but also how about a song where the, how do I put this? How about instead of during war, which the national anthem is doing,
right? Rockets, red glare.
It's
yeah.
It's about the flag enduring during times of war. How about we use a song instead, like, I don't know, like America the Beautiful, where
right.
its lyrics celebrate and inspire. Let me share just a couple of these verses with you. And I've thought about this before, right? Yes, I love the song more, but I love it more also for what it expresses. Oh, beautiful for heroes proved in liberating strife. Well, there's your celebration of enduring war right there.
Right.
These heroes who more than self their country loved. There's your patriotism. There's your selflessness. And mercy more than life. Wait a minute. These warriors, these patriots value mercy more than their own life. Doesn't that speak a little bit to your idea of the sensitivity training of our mm-hmm. protectors being merciful as an idealized objective? America, right. America, may God thy gold refine. This is an interesting alchemical reference, right? The idea of refining right. gold. And as you learned while making... you know, Truth Is Out There, and as we've learned with some of our interesting interviews for Truth Is Out There too, like with William Henry, this whole alchemical idea of refining the gold that is the spirit within each and every American, that's the reason this country was set up, a crucible that could refine the gold of our soul.
And shine it to a buff.
Till all success... be nobleness and every gain divine. So instead of America, we're number one, becoming number one means to achieve a level of nobility, a level of divinity yes. that does not need a goddamn rubber foam number one on its hand.
Right, because actually foam rubber is not so dignified after
exactly.
all.
Oh, beautiful... for patriot dream, there's that word again, patriot, that mm-hmm. sees beyond the years. That patriotism requires not getting bogged down in the fight of the here and the now, but in what will lead to these ideals in the future. So therefore, taking a knee to non-violently protest, to encourage conversation in this light... is incredibly patriotic. Though thine alabaster cities gleam undimmed by human tears. That's not a description we can apply to our cities in this country now, where all too many tears are shedding on a seemingly weekly basis from senseless violence. America, America, God shed his grace on thee, and crown thy good with what? With brotherhood from sea to shining sea. So that would be my national anthem were I allowed to make the choice.
Right. Now, one I probably wouldn't pick, though, when I got my U.S. citizenship, along with the recorded message of Barack Obama welcoming me, there was also... a lovely montage of scenery sung to Lee Greenwood's Proud to Be an American. And I'm not sure. I mean, the lyrics are good, but not as noble as the ones you have. So I think I agree with you, as opposed, I would have that played at the swearing in ceremony.
We rarely talk about sports. We rarely talk about music. And look at us. Putting our thumbprints all over both. And it's not going to stop there because I've got a live event of the week that I want to talk about that ties in with our discussion about nostalgia from last week's show. So
very good.
Why don't I play a little sting?
Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
And when I say a little sting, I don't mean sting, because it was actually a Hall & Oates concert that I went to.
You did not go to Hall & Oates.
At the Hollywood Bowl.
Wow.
Now, I went, in fairness, I literally went to eat and drink, and I stayed for the Hall & Oates.
That's one of the few venues you can do that.
This is such an exercise in nostalgia. And yes, they have a lot of famous songs. And all they do, of course, is play their famous songs. And I will say this. What's interesting is their 1970s songs that made them famous that really reflected that Philadelphia soul. You know, they came from Philadelphia. Those songs hold up really, really well. In fact, they performed a cover of the Righteous Brothers' You've Lost That Loving Feeling, which was their first big hit of the 80s. And I for Hall & Oates, when they did a cover of it, and I thought, wow, Hall & Oates' 70s songs like She's Gone, they hold up as songs, as well as the Righteous Brothers' You've Lost That Loving Feeling. Their songs from the 80s that were actually bigger hits once they became famous, it's all unlistenable garbage. And it plays only in the sense of nostalgia. And here's what nostalgia does for you. People loving this, go, oh, they're great. Hall & Oates, we love you, we love you, we love you. Then when the final encore ended without them doing Rich Girl, I thought we were going to have a riot. People were so angry with them. Fuck Hall & Oates. People are shouting.
And they were not.
Literally, a young woman turns to me and goes, why didn't they play Rich Girl? And I said to her, well, you're certainly asking the right person, first of all. And she said, why am I asking the right person? I said, you're not. You're insane. Get help. So anyway, so that was a wonderful exploration of the nostalgia of which we discussed the week before. But I did not know who the opening acts were. I didn't even know there were opening acts. Again, I might have mentioned I went for the food and the drink.
Right.
And to celebrate belatedly our friend Bert Bulos's birthday. Anyway, the first act was a fantastic band called Trombone Shorty and Orleans Ave. And this band, you know, I've been to other Hollywood Bowl shows. We've talked about this before, where the opening act kind of steals the thunder.
Oh, right? Yeah. The old Sammy Davis Jr. phenomena.
But they filled the bowl with their sound, with their voices, with their joy. No one who saw them, and of course, a lot of people come later to the bowl, no one who saw them would be talking about anything other than the performance of Trombone Shorty and Orleans Ave, except for the fact that the middle act was the great Miss Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. And I have been a fan of Sharon Jones for several years now. I've seen her perform at the Greek, but always as an opening act. And again, she was the opening act on this particular night, right before Hall & Oates, and it was amazing to witness, because she, as she says on stage in 2013, when she was 57 years old, did not know if she would make it to 58, because she had cancer.
Right.
And she beat the cancer, and now at 60, it has returned. And she's undergoing chemo. And she comes out on stage completely bald, has lost a lot of weight, but is still, don't kid yourself, 110 pounds of soul power. And during the first number, she has to leave the stage because she can't breathe.
Wow.
And she comes back a song later after removing her Spanx. That's
why she couldn't breathe?
No, but that was enough to allow for deeper breathing. So how crazy is this, that she's going through what she's going through and you still have to somehow pay, you know, attention to these things that performers are supposed to do, right? You got to wear the Spanx so you look tight and you look sexy and you look all this. And
how do you know she was wearing Spanx, and how do you know she removed it?
Because she said
it.
She said it.
Oh, did she?
Of course
she
did.
Gosh.
She told us everything. I mean, this was why people will remember this performance. Look, they do. Their music is fantastic, and her voice is great, though her voice did not have the strength that it did in the past. It got stronger as it went along. And by her final number, which was completely an improvised mantra that she sang and danced, explaining why it mattered to her to be there. Because, yes, she has cancer, but she's alive and has cancer. Yes, she has cancer, but she can sing and have cancer. She can dance and have cancer. We can come and see her perform, and she can have cancer. And the combination of those things, she says, inspire her to do her happy dance. And this performance, as she just stream of consciousness talked about this, started singing these words while dancing, was something that no one there will ever forget. And the point, I guess, I want to make about all this is nostalgia always pales in comparison to what is fresh, to what is vital, to that which literally breathes life back into things. And that's what we were witnessing on that stage before Hall & Oates came out.
I like it. That was totally worth going then.
Yeah, it was. It was really something to witness. Now, why don't we just keep talking about music, since we rarely do this?
Rarely do. Yes.
A few weeks ago, I told you about the wedding that I attended in San Francisco on Labor Day. What I had neglected to talk about was I got to spend a lot of time there with my friend Hamilton Lighthouser, who's been making music for more than 20 years, first with his very successful band, The Walkmen, and then on his fantastic, musically adventurous solo long player, Black Hours. You might remember that when he performed on Conan a few years back, singing with him was Miss Lily Holloman.
Oh, I do remember that.
And now, along with Rostam, the leader of another of my favorite bands, Vampire Weekend, Hamilton just dropped, although it's actually, as we're speaking on Thursday, it'll be tomorrow. But by the time people hear this, it will have been just a couple days ago. They will have dropped a new LP called I Had a Dream That You Were Mine. And they have a song in a blackout that is used in the new iPhone 7 commercial. So one imagines that that album is already financially successful by virtue of it being picked up for a commercial for the iPhone.
I would think so.
And I'm going to drop in to the show here a minute or so from the album's first single, A Thousand Times.
I had a dream that you were mine. I've had that dream a thousand times. A thousand times, a thousand times. I've had that dream a thousand times.
Dean, were you as broke up as I was about Brad Pitt's divorce from Angelina Jolie?
You know, I wasn't as broke up as you were.
Well, wait a minute. I wasn't broke up at all. So,
okay. So I was less than that.
So that means you were cheering it.
Well, no, I certainly never cheer anyone's strife or turmoil. I know that divorce and all of that is always a miserable situation. And so one would never cheer.
Right. One would never cheer. unless one maybe had seen their movie By the Sea from last year, in which case one might be saying, you bastards had it coming.
Because
I mean, the movie was one of the worst movies ever made. Yeah. And also, by the way, I hear that apparently she treated him horribly on the set of that thing.
Oh,
like,
no.
The writing was on the wall, how much she belittled him and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah. And one would imagine that, you know, when you got a power couple like that, there's power involved. And so, any relationship is always a delicate, playful negotiation of power. And if you are accumulating and thriving and trading in, as one does in Hollywood, in power, you know that's going to bleed into the relationship in some unusual and therefore terrible ways.
I can't understand why people take possession of these public figures' marriages and relationships so much, but we see it all the time throughout history, and we're seeing it now. I mean, the heartbreak and the anger and the fighting and people picking sides over the divorce of these people that they've never met and will never know. I don't understand really why anyone cares, first of all. And the other thing about it, especially all the anger that is being directed towards her in this situation, yeah. I would point out that Angelina Jolie, God bless her, has been bag of cats crazy forever. There's been no hiding this fact. She does a lot of wonderful work through the United Nations. She does a lot of wonderful work as an actress. I'm sure she loves her 97 adopted children deeply.
Absolutely.
I would think that after 95, maybe at some point you have the conversation of, look, are we really sure that we're well fit as a married couple to keep getting these? But anyway, Santa kept bringing them, so they kept giving them a home. But the
I didn't know it was Santa.
But the point that I'm getting to here is there have always been. She was previously married to Billy Bob Thornton. Right.
Right.
So there's a little bit of a red flag.
Absolutely.
And then felt the need to show her love for her husband by wearing a vial of his blood around her neck all the time.
And him as well, with matching tattoos of some viral.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a debate about Billy Bob Thornton, crazy, not crazy. I mean, I think we already... So... Anyway, but that just makes him cool. I think this is the point that I'm kind of getting to, though. Billy Bob Thornton, anything that he does just makes him more Billy Bob Thornton, which we accept is cool. And Angelina Jolie, it seems like she's either a saint or crazy, is almost the reaction. And now there's all this anger about the crazy Angelina Jolie, right? The Angelina Jolie who made out with her brother throughout an Oscar ceremony on television, right? Jolie who was raised by John Voight, who, let's face it, is the lights are on and nobody's been home for a long, long time.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's a bigger story right there, I think, being, when your parents are insane.
And didn't Angelina Jolie have every one of her sexual organs removed preventatively? I mean,
she had a high. Oh my gosh!
I'm exaggerating a little bit.
I'm supporting. I'm attacking your humor with support for Angelina, having done a lot of personal work to get where she is.
Well, you've done that Swedish sensitivity training, so you would have been. Right. God bless you. You would have been able to massage, I'm sure, even this messy divorce situation. But the point that I want to get to is just everybody freaking out, having any energy about this, and especially directed towards her, and supposedly her problems or whatever it was. First of all, again, none of your business. It has nothing to do with you. Your life doesn't change. But also, all the things, again, that you love about someone like an Angelina Jolie, I'm going to suggest are not in spite of these things that come up from time to time, but might also be coming from the exact same place that these things come from, right? We've got to get over this idea of, oh, I really liked him as a political leader. I like what he did for this, this, and this. It's just too bad that he had to do this and this and this over here. Okay, yes, I guess in an ideal world, but it might have been coming from the exact same thing, right? Our strengths will become our weaknesses. The good acts that we do often come from the same spaces within us that promote the bad acts within us. As an artist, our own seeming madness is also the path to our great epiphanies and the things that we can share, right?
Right.
So lay off. It's healthier for her, and it's a hell of a lot healthier for all of us if we care without attachment.
Yes. Yes. And as you said, this leads to a healthier path. You go through all the crazy and the madness and relationships and all of that sort of thing to get to somewhere amazing. So let us all hope that this path leads to somewhere amazing for all of us.
We have to do a very special installment of what we're reading because of an email that we received from a listener. So let me play this sting, the brand new What We Are Reading sting, and then we'll talk about it.
Okay.
You see, it's appropriate, Dean, because the email from a listener is about a book series, and it also comes to us from the man who wrote and performed the What We Are Reading sting. It comes to us from John Lawler.
Oh.
Our once
Thanks, John.
And perhaps future guest on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, who does the usual theme that is unheard on this week's show. Phil, I just wanted to write you to let you know that bringing up Harry Potter in any way may bring you some serious blowback from fan canons. Fanons, if you will. Because, if you'll recall, I guess I talked about Harry Potter. Somehow we brought up Harry Potter last week. And,
the revival or something?
I guess we were talking about Alfonso Cuarón and talking about how first good Harry Potter
movie. And now Chris Columbus.
Right, we were talking about adaptations. Yeah, we were talking about adaptations. Yes. Oh, Susanna Clarke's Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, and how I compared the challenge faced by the writers adapting the book into the miniseries as being akin to the challenge faced and failed by the adaptations of the first two Harry Potter books. So
exactly.
The only thing I wanted to mention was, say what you will about Chris Columbus, and I'm sure you've said a lot. I feel that the first two Harry Potter movies captured the mood of the books pretty well. That's good that you feel that, John, even though they don't. But they gave you the sense of wonder that a child might have when reading this. Yes, an uneducated, illiterate child, as in, I wonder what the hell this is about. The first film is not bad, and not bad makes it maybe the best film that Chris Columbus has ever done. that second film is unwatchable, and in fact, proof of this is for those people who did not read the books, which is, by the way, the vast majority of people who watch the movies, right? Far more people watch the movies than read the books. They're books. People don't read. And
But it's Harry Potter, for crying out loud.
But I did do a canvassing at one point of people after the second movie came out. And what was stunning was how little they could remember from the first movie, but they really felt like almost everything in the second movie had been already in the first movie.
Yeah.
It's really regurgitated. It's really stilted. And that second movie is the reason why Chris Columbus got fired from directing the movies.
Because he wasn't expanding.
The behest of no less a Potter fan, a fodder, we'll call it, or a pan.
A pan. Fodder pan.
This woman, and tell me if I'm getting the name right, J.K. Rowling?
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah. She's a big fan of it, for sure.
Let's continue. Interestingly, the third movie was the least like the books in so many ways that it actually turned me off.
Oh, now that's interesting.
That's right at the beginning. I was turned on. I loved the dark, creepy vibe that was there, and I loved the story that they followed. But they left out more story and randomly rearranged things for seemingly no reason in that one. When you say they, again, I'm not even going to debate this one. I'm going to let J.K. Rowling handle it.
Okay.
It's her favorite of the movies. Let me repeat that. J.K. Rowling's favorite of the movies is the third one, Prisoner of Azkaban. It did not have the success of the first two, nor did Empire Strikes Back have the success of any of the others, right? It, to this day, is the least successful Star Wars movie.
However, agreed to be critically the best.
The best.
In terms of tone.
It's the best by all fan accounts. And it's also the only Star Wars film that matters for non-Star Wars fans, right?
Right.
Harry Potter, Prisoner of Azkaban is very much the same. So it's J.K. Rowling's favorite. And the first one where she felt, wait for it, they captured the tone of the book.
But now here's the thing. When you read, do you know the American version of Harry Potter is 34 pages longer than the British version because they had to explain a lot of things about the British school system in the American books. So the tone of the American one is technically somewhat not watered down, but by lightly explaining how the school system works and the rules of Quidditch that everybody in the UK would know because they grew up with it and that doesn't need explaining. It's technically two different books, so I believe that if you read the British version, you'll have a darker feel than have you read the American version.
So I'm not going to talk about any of this because apparently I will have a lot of
fanon balls. You're going to have fanon balls flying through your window.
So magical ones. So Expelliarmus, Deflecto. So anyway,
well done.
She, J.K. Rowling, very much tried to keep Alfonso Cuarón in to direct more of the movies, and he really there was no challenge there. So he left after that. Now, in terms of rearranging the story and cutting things out, again. That's all J.K. Rowling. She wrote the outlines. She worked with the screenwriters. They then wrote the screenplays. But they neither cut anything out nor rearranged anything without her doing it first.
Right.
Why did they do this? Why did they do this, Dean Haglund? I know you're dying to find out. Because everyone knew there were going to be seven books. And only one person on this planet knew what unfolded, and therefore only one person on this planet knew what was important to keep and what was not important to keep. So anything that was cut out was, according to her, not important. And truthfully, you can start from the third movie and follow the actual story. I would say the story begins there, and that the second movie is unnecessary altogether because it's just a rehash of the first one. And the first one is prologue.
Backstory, yeah.
But you don't need me to say it because J.K. Rowling has said it for me. Anyway, but she can be wrong, and she can be wrong. And you're entitled to your opinion, John. And especially because John loved the fact, he does go on to say, I know from a filmmaking perspective, I'm remarkably out of my depth. I don't think it's remarkable in any way how you're out of your depth.
To support John Lauer, though, I want to bring up another fun historical fact.
Okay.
Margaret Mitchell, who wrote Gone with the Wind.
And made up the whole story.
Yes.
About Atlanta, because there was no Atlanta. But go ahead, please.
So, Gone with the Wind, huge epic novel, big bestseller. They go to her to say, we're having trouble not just casting Vivian Leigh, but who should be Rhett Butler? And she had one name above and beyond who was in her mind the entire time she was writing the novel. Who's that actor? Groucho Marx.
I would have liked that movie.
Vivian Leigh and Groucho Marx?
Yeah.
Frankly, Scarlett, I don't give a damn.
Yeah.
So it would have been a killer end line.
It would have taken the sting out of all the painful racism in the movie. Just a little bit. Anyway. Well, so I don't really quite understand your point, except that you're saying that J.K. Rowling should have had a part for Groucho Marx. Anyway.
No. Back the writers to John, can have a different.
Right, they can
mind.
Be wrong. They can be wrong. You're absolutely right. So John says, I know from a filmmaking perspective, I'm remarkably out of my depth, so I'm not saying you were wrong. You already know you weren't. I just wanted to say I found it interesting that you mentioned how lacking the first two movies were, and yet they were, from a story perspective, the most complete. And here I will step in and say, from a story perspective, they were utterly lacking, and this was the point of what we talked about last week. From a plot perspective, they were complete. And plot has not the same meaning as story. Story comes from character. It is the exploration of how characters evolve through their interaction with the world and with the events of the plot. Story is not the same. We follow story. And the story of those first two is quite lacking. And one of the reasons that it's lacking, and what ties it entirely to the filmmaking perspective, is that the performances of those kids are so completely lacking. It is not until they ditched the hack at the helm and brought in an actual storyteller that, lo and behold, all of those kids started giving good performances.
Right. Yeah, so. And had reason and stakes and stuff like that. Things were raised.
All right, so I could go on with his email.
But I feel the cannon balls heading your way.
No, I quoted J.K. Rowling. It was all J.K. Rowling. It was, you know. But if the point was to take, this is what he writes. If the point was to take the idea and make an adaptation or riff on it, like a Shining situation, I would totally agree. But I think they really were just going for as close a representation of the books as possible. Maybe you're right. Maybe that was the creative impulse behind Chris Columbus, which was the reason he's a hack and why he's fired. You know why you don't need as close a representation of the books as possible? Because if you are capable of reading, you have the books.
Yes, exactly.
You're making a film. You do no justice to the books by making a shitty movie, which is what they did with the second one, or a mediocre movie, which they did with the first one. You pay
it's
honor
a photocopy
to the,
of the book.
Source
yeah.
material by doing something that is viable on its own, especially when you have the author of the books teaching you how to do that. The difference with The Shining, of course, was that Stephen King, for many years, didn't like that Stanley Kubrick did an adaptation that was its own expression. He now looks back and acknowledges it's the masterpiece of the genre, right?
Right. Exactly.
But here's a case where the actual author is saying, would you please stop trying to do two-dimensional photocopies of the book, and would you start, please, trying to make movies? You know, this is why she prevented Steven Spielberg from directing those movies, which he wanted to do, because she was very careful to protect certain things about it, i.e. this film had to be British. Steven Spielberg wanted American actors. But also, she wanted to make sure at the same time that it could stand on its own as a movie. So there you go. I don't know if we've solved
answered
anything here.
No,
but it was a heck of a lot of fun. You know what I am going to do? We've never done it within a section before. We've never made one section be two sections. But I'm also going to make what we're reading be our explanation of the week.
Hooray!
The Chilpack Hollywood explanation of the week.
And that brings you to the end of, I think, a damn entertaining installment of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. You can find every episode we've ever done at chilpackhollywood.com.
Yes, you can. And you can find us on iTunes and
you can download them, stream them, and you can subscribe via iTunes there.
Write a review on iTunes. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/chilpackhollywood. And
like us. Please like
us. You can like us there. Yes. And of course, you can email us, like we've already said, at chilpackhollywood@yahoo.com. And follow us on Twitter. We're Dean and Phil, where we also exist on Instagram. We're your king of the hashtags.
Hashtag,
yes.
We give good hashtag. That's hashtags it. Thanks to Blog Talk Radio for hosting us. I'm Phil Larinus, and I'm going to end this show with the soulful sounds of Miss Sharon Jones. I'll talk to you next week, Dean Haglund.
Thank you, Phil Larinus.
100 days, 100 nights, to know a man's heart. 100 days, 100 nights, to know a man's heart. And a little more before he knows it's all.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.